that it seems from Rav Nosson HaBavli, and that's something that you mentioned last time, is that Rav Nosson HaBavli's accounts, how he would come by the Kala, the month of Adar, and the month of Elul, and that's when everybody gathered, all the Talmidim gathered, and the reason being is because then they would be able to take off from their Parnasa, from the agriculture, and come and learn yeshiva full time, because it was a slow month agriculturally, right? But also, on the other hand, it also gained the fact that you had all these Talmidim who were able to learn during the entire year, because they weren't necessarily stuck in the academy. They were able to go back home, live, bring in a parnasa, make a living on the land, and learn in the various Bata Midrashas that they had wherever they were dispersed. So the concept of the Kala was that, you know, you had the Talmidim that were there the whole year, but you also had Talmidim, and they were not just Balabatim. People think today Yachid Kala is called for Balabatim, right? People want to come learn, they go Thanksgiving weekend, the week to Israel, Yachid Kala. In those times, Yachid Kala wasn't for the Balabatim. These were people who would learn the entire year, but in a place where they were living, so they can cultivate the land, make a living, learn at the same time. They had chavrusas, and they would learn in the Bata Midrashas, and they'd gather together twice a year to discuss everything that they learned, and see that they learned it right, and have the shiurim, and etc., etc. So the Yachid Kala, the months of Kala, was not for, on the outside, for Balabatim. Then they had Pirka, by the way. Well, Sidi Gemara discusses Pirka, when they would give a shiur on Shabbos afternoon, and they'd weave together the halacha and the hadrasha and everything together in the big shiur Shabbos afternoon. That's Pirka. But Yarche Kala was specifically geared towards the learners, towards the Talmidim. Just they were also working, they would work in their fields and learn, and then come once, twice a year back to the Masifta. But this is not to say there were no Talmidim there the whole year. And what we did see 2 weeks ago is that, you know, remember you said that they would ask, they bring the tshuvas, all the shilas that they brought from the entire 6 months, so to speak. That's what it sounds like with Nosson HaBavli. And they'd pose the question, and then they'd discuss it with everybody there, and then they'd give the answer, and the Goyin would sign his name to it. Hence you had tshuvas ha-goyinim, the tshuva of the Goyinim. So he says, it's misleading. It's misleading to think that the tshuvas, the shilas, were only answered twice a year. Remember you asked me that question? It's misleading to think, because Nosson, the yeshivas were open, number one. Number two, Nosson HaBavli says, he came to the yeshivas during the month of Kala. And that's when he saw they're asking all these questions, and he wrote his answer, you know, and the Goyin, they would discuss it together, and the Goyin would put his name to the tshuva, and it would be sent out. But it does not to say that they didn't have shilas the entire year that was discussed by the yeshiva and signed off by the Goyin. And he brings proof to that. We have dates of various tshuvas which were written throughout the year. Not necessarily in the month of Adar or the month of Elul. Proof number one. Another proof he has from another tshuva, some tshuva in the Goyinim, that after they all left in the month of Nisan, because clearly then they probably did go home, even the Talmidim probably went home for Pesach, so the Rosh Kala, or not the Rosh Kala, the Rosh Masifta, the head of the Masifta, called back an emergency, maybe he should come back right after Pesach, I guess, right after Yontif, because there's a big discussion, a big Shaila that came up, and we need to discuss, because I need to send an answer right away. And I guess that was the time when the Talmidim were not in Yeshiva, was during Pesach time, and therefore he called them all back, and want to discuss with everybody. So clearly, it wasn't that only Shailas were asked twice a year. He said, that's misleading. If you read Nosson HaBavli's account, it would seem that that's what happened, but that's not true. It's just he was there during those months, and that's when he saw it happened, and he figured only then it took place. But clearly, it did not only take place then, the Shailas were asked throughout the year. So that's according to Brody. It's true. Makes sense. 100%. And he has proofs from the various tshuvas.
Isn't that the key point of the whole Gaonim period? The first time ever the shilas were asked from the entire world?
Correct. And it only became more and more.
Of course he's right then.
It's hard to say it was only during the 2 months a year.
It's open then, but then you just have an influx of people.
Right. Well, no, but the way it sounded from him is that the shilas were left until that month, at the end of the year. It can be. Right? It doesn't make sense. Can be, and he brings proofs from various tshuvas. Yeah, you're right. The first time, by the way, obviously the learning was different insofar that they had a book to learn. They had the Mishnah, they had the Gemara, they had the Talmud Bavli. It was contained. It wasn't just all over. It was contained within that Talmud Bavli. Then they expounded past it, obviously. But therefore, when you had Shilas, which were being discussed, it wasn't just, okay, I guess suppose in the olden days, when you had a Shaila, that became part of the discussion in the Amoraic period. Somebody had a Shaila, it became part of the discussion, and eventually it became part included in the Gemara, right? Every Gemara is, boy is so-and-so, Eishvei so-and-so. Now, once you have the Gemara as a final book of Torah Shebaal Peh, so when there's a Shaila asked, you need to give a tshuva. You can't say, okay, it's a good discussion, and let's discuss it and write it into our book and include it in the future learning. Can't do that, because the book's closed. So when there's a Shaila, we need to give you a tshuva. Right? We can't have a discussion and, all right, we'll put it in for the next generation. No, I need to give you a tshuva. But, you'll notice we're going to do it next week more in depth. The tshuva sagoinim, in a way, does mimic somewhat the Gemara. It's not just, you know, a tshuva. Well, the Gemara said like this, and if it must be like that. It goes through a whole discussion, almost like a form of a Gemara. It's quite interesting. The early tshuva sagoinim was written like that.
Because they don't have the advantage of the riff from the Torah and everything else.
Clearly not. Clearly not. But even the way it's answered is, I think it's answered almost like in a discussion form, right? Rather than in a Shaila tshuva form. Now, it could be because that's the way it was discussed in the Masifta. More likely, because that's the way the learning was done in the Gemara.
Didn't they use also the proofs from the same Gemara?
Of course they use the proofs from the same Gemara. 100% they use the same proofs from the same Gemara. But it wasn't just, you know, I guess because there weren't so many sources, so it was more the shakla v'tayra in the Gemara, the back and forth in the Gemara, which was incorporated inside that tshuva to show what the answer would be. We'll do that when we go through the tshuvas in depth. You know, the style of the tshuvas, perhaps. Much more, I don't know, more or less, I don't know. I mean, for those times, it was complicated. Then we'll see what the shilas were. We'll go through some of the tshuvas, I suppose. We'll see what the shilas were, I don't know. What was that?
He had the advantage of technology. They didn't have the advantage of technology.
The Moshe is after everything. Exactly. The shilas get more complicated, I suppose. But it's not true, but... Right, and he based himself on the tshuvas of the original ones.
The truth is, how difficult can the shilas have been?
Right. And that's why most of the time they would go through the Gemara and say, "No, what do you mean? It's quite over here." Well, there's nothing else to go through, basically. What technology?
Technology is why all these shilas are. So
no, but they had Shilas, the tshuvas of Rishonim.
You always have tshuvas, but in order to put something in, can I use a Shabbos clock on Shabbos?
Okay.
When there was no such thing, you know, that's a monumental thing that is abortion. Abortion, I imagine they had dealt with also. Fertilization, you know, all sorts of shalas that...
Modern shalas.
Modern shalas that... They
yeah, but these are not the only shalas. You open up a tshuva, it was Moshe or any other tshuva, major shalas on gittin, on kashos of gittin, on lungs of animals, treif. I mean, plenty of other shalas, not just technological shalas. And they also could have asked those shalas. And they probably did ask such shalas. And they formed the basis of further tshuvas. But we'll see that when we go to the tshuvas of Gittin, we'll give a special shiur on that. On the style of the tshuva sagoinim, how it was answered. Perhaps it was, and I looked into it a little bit.
The stylistic,
it was in a way similar to the Gemara, which is not surprising, because that's where they were coming from.
They lived in the same place.
That's where they're coming from, and that was the way, it was studied, the way it was learned. Now, so that's regarding the tshuvas given by the goinim. But we saw it last week a little bit. I want to know about the division of powers, and this is important. There was the exilarch, which was the Reish Kalusa. Reish Kalusa, his main power, yeah, he was the representative, but because of that, he had a direct line to the king, meaning the Persian king or the Arabian king or the caliph, whoever was in charge, he had a direct line. He was a representative of the Jewish people. So obviously, they gave him the proper covet, and many times he was a learned individual from the... You know, from the Goyim period, a scholar, a Talmud Chacham. Was he necessarily the greatest? No. Did he go through the same process that to become a Goyim? Clearly not. It was usually a father to son. You know, Reish Galusa went from Exilach, father to son. It was more like a royal line, Malchus Beis David. But we saw, last week we saw, for example, when they crowned him, and they did his hachtara, and they did his, you know, initiation ceremony, it was done with all the ceremony, and the two Rashi Yeshiva, the two Reish Mesiftas, the Goinim, would come and pay homage to him, and etc., etc. But still we saw that, yes, they gave him covet, and he was, so to speak, the top, but they also kept their own. For example, we saw that after he got his Aliyah Shlishi on his, you know, Shabbos, when they made him the next Exilarch, then the Rosh Hashivas didn't get after him. That's really embarrassing, you know. It's one thing if you don't take anything, but to get, he gets Shlishi and you get Revi and Chamishi, that's already... No. You get Shlishi, you get Revi and Chamishi, that means you're secondary to him. That they didn't want to show. So therefore, you know, we saw, at least I saw that yes, the Exilarch was the top, and he probably wielded the most power, but at the same time, they did what they could to give the independence to the Rashi Mesifta, the Goyinim, that they should not be completely under him. You know, we see that every now and then, we see that. I did not see, though, we did not discuss what were his, not just what he was able to do, and it says that whenever he would walk outside, everybody would follow him, and he had all his servants running in front of him with his carriage and all that, but how did he have his wealth? How did he have his power? What was he in control over? And again, Nussan, and actually you saw this professor, Brody, that quotes, he quotes a lot, Nussan Abavli, because he said he'd get a glimpse, you know, even though he says he might see it from one side only, the son of an exilarch, so he might see, paints everything so favorably, but nevertheless, you get a glimpse of what the power base, what life was like by the exilarch versus the rabbis. So if you look in page 85, he talks actually about the money. So line number 16, page 85, you have 84, 85. So the second paragraph, which is 85, the second paragraph. In other words, this is how he would collect his wealth. Mimokim echod hanikro Naharvan, v'chol parvara, which means all the suburbs of Naharvan, v'urochik mibovel k'moy chatzi yoyim b'mizrocha. It's a half a day's travel eastward of Bovel. What's Bovel? I guess Bovel is the center, right? Nardo, m'chuzo, so half a day travel eastwards. Now, what would he do? He would do like this. That was his province. They had three provinces, or they divided Bovel and the areas around it into three separate provinces. The province of the Reish Galusa, the province of Sura, and the province of Narda. So now he's talking about the province of the Reish Galusa. So there was a large area. Narda, what would he do? Pumbedisa. What?
Narda, Pumbedisa.
No, I said Sura, Pumbedisa. Oh, I didn't say Sura, Pumbedisa, and Reish Galusa.
South and east.
Correct. Middle, south, and north. He said like this. Line number 17. Umoitze aleihem dayan birshusai. He would appoint a dayan, the Reish Galusa, would appoint a dayan to his area, to his area that under his control, uvishus Rashi Hashivas. But it was also done with the permission of the Rashi Hashivas. In other words, the two goyim had to sign off on this appointment of this dayan, the Reish Galusa's dayan. Now, why was it important to send a dayan? So he said like this: v'kaysev lo aleihem, and he would write to them ki loka chashus mehem, that he got permission from, I guess, from the Rashi Yeshivas, I suppose, umoitze, or maybe from the three people, umoitze elav min amokam hu, and he would send him to that place, or he'd bring him back from that place. Vaykones lo mishom k'moy shishim o ayin zehuvim. It had to do with money. If you appointed a dayan to a certain area, then this dayan would be in charge of the hashgachas, be in charge of the butchers, be in charge of the dinei Torah. He would get paid, and the Reish Galusa would also get money from that. That was his man. Now, how does the Reish Galusa have a person in his area? Why? He just puts guards over there to collect taxes. based on what you're collecting taxes. But if I'm providing you a service, I'm giving you a dayan who's going to pass in all your shaylas, who's going to be the rabbinic figure under my auspices, so that is, it was a way also to collect money.
But he did collect taxes. That was
he collected taxes also.
For the government.
Correct. He collected for the government. He also collected for himself. He had his own income. He had to, I guess he had his own thing he had to take care of, right? He had a whole royal thing to. Exactly. Everything he had to run over there. So read. Let's describe. He describes how he would appoint a dayan and what he would do there. So he says, Ukshemagia Lashami would go there. And this dayan would choose two from the Tamid HaChamim, from that area that he would go to, to be counted amongst him, and all the, he'd be part of the Beis Din. Now that this one dayan that was sent by the Reish Galusa, he would take along with him two others, locals, and they would sit together on all the Dinei Torah. Number 20. And if this dayan that was appointed was Yosha b'drachav, he was honest, v'naki b'dinov, kosvu, so then the Rashi HaMokim HaChashuvim, the heads of that area, the important people, would send to the Reish Galus, u'mashapchin Reish HaBeinov, said, oh, you sent us a fantastic man, he's very good. And if, however, he was a dud, because it happened also sometimes, they would send, complain. Now, when they give praise, they only send to the Reish Galus. When they complain, what do you send us a guy like that for? They complain to everybody. The Reish Galus, the Rosh Yeshivas, Pliny, that person, Kamaku Kolim Maisov, he's a corrupt person. The Kamam Churam Drochov, he's bad. They get rid of him right away. They appoint somebody else. Now, what happens? Line 24. This is the rule. Shadayin noitel me'anshe amokon. The dayin takes from the people of that city where he is. Mikol echad shu ben esrim shana mamalo. Anybody that's 20 and above. Shnei zuzim b'shana. Zuz b'pesach. Mezuz b'sukkos. In other words, hetax. You want a dayin? I'm providing you a service. You got dinei Torah. You got somebody to pass from all your shaylas. Somebody charged with hashgachas. Hetax. Two zuz a person. Now. Umeaksuba. V'get, ushtar choyv, ushtar matana, ushtar mechira. Everything costs money. You want to do a get? You got to pay extra. You want to do a ksuba? You got to pay extra. You want to have a ushtar choyv? You want to have a heter iska? You want to go business with somebody? You want to have a certain IOU signed? Go prom, go to the dime. It's going to cost you. Another, you pay the two head tax, the two zoos head tax, off the bat to pay for the rov. But you also have to pay for all services that this dayan renders. And then they also had a sefer scribe. In other words, the dayan would decide, okay, this is a scribe, you gotta pay him, the community's gotta pay him X amount. He ran a whole, you know, a whole rabbinic court over there. Everything costs money, and people would pay for their services. And that's how the dayan would get his money. Now, whether the dayan was in town or the dayan was not in town, you had to pay him. If he decided to go somewhere else, right, he was out of town, he put somebody else instead, didn't make a difference. You paid the dayan for all the services. V'adayan, now look a little further. Now, line 28. V'adayan, yesh lo shnei bnei adam. The dayan has two people, shema'aynim, v'choykrin, u'mashkifin, al-kol v'shusay, shleya d'mayse, so-and-so. In other words, he appointed people to make sure that nobody's playing no hanky-panky, everybody's paying the way. He had his people, they also got a salary, I suppose, to make sure everybody ends up paying. Now, me'el adom shukasav me'el al-pil, fine. Now, next thing, v'chol mishu oise, shoma v'seisa, menad oise, v'koyne oise, in other words, whoever did not pay, or did things behind the dayan's back, line number 1 in 86, so he would menada isoi, he'd put him in cherem, mekainis isoi, shitin schar ashtar, you couldn't just get away without paying, because the dayan had powers. Umalkeyu, he would give him malkus, mimhoyani, if he had no money, shluchol asadoba kotsuf, noyti menasem kviyasof yzele b'shus adayin. So then you pay whatever the dayan decides that you have to pay. We're not finished yet. Line number three.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem like they're arguing this.
What?
Based on the first lines of that tshuva, it doesn't seem that they had a problem with that.
No. This way it ran beautifully.
Yeah.
People were very happy. I paid for my dayan. It wasn't a bad thing. It wasn't corruption. It wasn't extortion. You paid for a dayan. This is from the Reish Galusa. This is the Reish Galusa's dayan, appointed by the Rosh Yeshivas. We need a rabbinic figure over here. They paid him. There was nothing wrong with that.
It doesn't seem that they had a problem paying it.
No. No, who said it was?
No, because in that first line they said, if the guy was good, fine. Everything's
that's
good.
Right.
If the guy was no good.
I got rid of the guy.
Yeah, exactly.
100%.
But the concept wasn't a problem.
The concept was not a problem. This is probably the first time I've seen such a concept. That's why I think it's fascinating. They ran that. No wonder you wonder why it lasted so many years. Bavel, they know how to run a good thing. Because
they never have problems.
They never, people paid. People had money. People paid. If you didn't have money, you paid a little bit less. But and that was that. It was income for the dying, but not just for the dying. Number three, v'yesh ledayin, and the dying has ala tabochim. What's the tabochim?
Butcher.
The butchers. Butchers, right? Nid hashgacha. Butchers, meat. Zuz b'chol shavua v'shavua. You paid two zuz a person for an entire year. If you're a butcher, you paid 50 zuz a year. Wow, that's a lot. 50 zuz a year as a butcher. V'gav l'reish galus. Also the reish galusa, this was his jurisdiction. He also got money. Yovelov mishus, medinas pras, b'chol shono, eshim zuvim al zeh minik. In other words, he would get from the in different countries, every area would pay their tax to the Reish Galusa. Maybe the money, the part of the butcher money, went to the Reish Galusa as well, went to pay the dayan, but there was a money constantly flowing from the territory to the Reish Galusa, either to his dayan, to the dayan's people that he needed to make sure it got enforced, to the Reish Galusa. It was a payment. They paid for it. It was a tax. A tax which was sent to the Reish Galusa. Now, look in line four. V'yesh l'makam achan nikru chalvan. A different area you had. Beino v'ein bol mahalachei yomim. Much further away. A 5-day trip. U'mekabu menu kufnun zuvim. He would get 150 gold coins in a year. Al choy kaniskar. The same way. With the butchers. With the people. With the head tax. V'gam yesh l'makam achan. Hanikru katzel. V'yesh muladatoi. V'yesh menu l'am zuvushana. In other words, they had rich provinces, they had poor provinces. In other words, they always had, the Reish Galusa had, under his jurisdiction, whole number of provinces, and he'd get money from all these provinces. How would he get money? I suppose all these places, he would send a dayan, and the dayan would do the services, and they'd pay him, and the dayan would pay back the Reish Galusa, and part of the money went directly to the Reish Galusa, and that's how he had his people in all these places, and he had funds, and the people were happy, and he was happy, and everything worked just fine. That's what seems to happen. Now, there's something else. If you lived in the hometown of the Reish Galusa, you paid extra money. Why? Because he's your buddy. Imagine, you know, you live on in Trump Tower. Live in Trump Tower. That's a schus. Why schus? You got an ear of the president, right? It's worthwhile. Oh, yeah, also, if you lived in the Reish Galusa's hometown, then you already paid much more money.
But there's something else. You're wealthier.
Is that maybe it is? Maybe. Look at number six. Line six. V'yesh le b'bovel b'mokom. B'bovel has a place. Shisham b'esai. That's where he lives. V'hu b'shusai. It's always in his jurisdiction. V'yesh le sham al kol echel v'echem Yisrael. Shnei zuzim b'pesach v'sukkos. He gets two zuzim. That sounds like the same. Okay. Maybe they don't pay as much. V'einu notem menanim klum. And you don't pay anything from the poor people. Maybe this was in addition. I don't know. And the butchers give him much less for some reason. I don't know. They give him a quarter of a zuv every year. I don't know. Maybe this was in addition to the regular. Maybe this was, that's why I think it was in addition to the regular money they had to pay the local dayan, they would have to give the Reish Galusa himself also for the schus for living in his town. So in addition to the regular taxes they would pay to the dayan that was there, that was part of their province, but they also had to give the Reish Galusa separately because they were under his direct jurisdiction perhaps. There was his hometown, they had an ear with him, and therefore they paid him more money. I think that's what it is.
Is his main source of income tax?
Well, the klola shel davar, the rule of thumb was, shemagia lo b'chol shon v'chon v'kol ein v'kolis, tafshin zuhuvin. He got 700 gold coins every year
from all his provinces. Now, besides that, he also owned a lot of land. Don't forget, the Reish Galusa comes from a distinguished family, royal family, from the Melech Yehuda, right? The last king of Yehuda, Yehoyachin Melech Yehuda. So besides, he had this income, this taxes, he also had lands, and I suppose lands had sharecroppers, and that also was an income to him, and that's how he had his wealth. Now you might think this is a lot, 700 gold coins. We're going to soon see that the Rashi Mesifta, the Rosh Hashiva of Sura, and the Rosh Hashiva of Pumbedisa also had their provinces, and they did the same thing, also with the Dayanim that they pointed out, and they got much more. They got 1,500 gold coins a year.
But isn't that part of what we believe, that we always have to enrich in the Rosh Hashiva?
I know. They got double the money. That could be the Reish Galusa had his own wealth, and the Rosh Hashiva did not necessarily have his own wealth. That could be. It could also be the Rosh Hashiva, the Reish Masifta, he had a much bigger budget. He had to support all these Talmidim. I don't know.
No, I don't know, but we always, from him alone, it's always...
Then he always gave more money to the Rosh Reish Masifta. Yeah, could be. Could be that's the reason. I don't know, I'm just telling you the fact. Now, before we get to the Reish Masifta, he said, by the way, he says that he, not just he wielded power, and he got all his money, but in line number 10, Imrotza, if he wanted, Kaisev Limekaimez Rechaikais, he can send to any place, even not on his jurisdiction, Shismuchu Bichabdu, you know, I want this from you. Kaisev Lem, Boisim Le Bakashosai. He would write to them, and they would do what he wanted. Vim Yotza Benoishel Reish Golus, and if the son of the Reish Golusa, the crown prince, would go, Lechol Mokam Shigietze, any place that he wanted to go, it didn't make a difference if it was his jurisdiction or not. Noisin loy panim, they give him the kavod. Umechabdi noisoy, v'noisin loy mincha, they give him gifts. Ve'enem nimnoim nimzoy, mizeh adavar, and they don't hold back anything. Aval oisim kum imoy kol echad ve'echad v'ichvoid l'fir gadlusoy, they give him the proper kavod. Line number 12, v'im loy yisil loy panim, and if they would not honor the son of the Reish Galusa, v'lo yichabdu b'matnoseim, shaleach aviv psichais v'charamlis, then the father, the Reish Galusa, would send him warnings that if you don't give my son the proper covet, I'm going to put you in chevim. But I'll finish it. V'omar zeh Reb Nosson, and Reb Nosson says, shiroh es benoi, I guess it wasn't written by him, or maybe this was V'omar Reb Nosson. Reb Nosson says, shiroh es benoi shal David ben Zakai. He saw the son...
That's very interesting. He's one of the last ones.
One of the last ones, the 900s, yeah. 950s. So he saw the son of one of the last exilarchs, David ben Zakkai, Shiyot Lemdinas Pras, they went to Persia, Shum Yer Shusar, it happened to have been his father's jurisdiction, V'loi Kibdu, V'loi Nasuponov, and they didn't give him the proper covet. V'sholach V'diyas Aviv. And the father, he told his father, Daddy, they're not respecting me over here. They didn't give me gifts. Line 15, Ba'aviv Haitzi Aleim, Psichois V'acharamois. And he started sending Cherims, Vaidia Lemishne. He told the vice president of Babylonia, of Persia, Va'amishne Vaidia Lemelech. And the vice president went to tell the king, because of Amelech Lemelech Pras. And then the king of Arabia sent to the king of Persia, Lismoich Yodel Ozraleim, you help me out with this renegade province that's not giving the proper covet to the son of the Reish Galusa. Who got involved? The king of Arabia, the non-Jewish king, would send a letter to the Persian king that there's a province under your jurisdiction that's not giving covet to my friend, the Reish Galusa's son. And when the king of Persia, line 16, he received this letter, scathing letter from the king of from Arabia, Sholach Yod Behem, so he already taught them a lesson. V'notol Momenu Momen Habe Mipras Shurisus Aviv Umkul Pava V'Yigiyev Chazal Bavel. In other words, the king of Persia put his foot down. He already collected a high tax from this renegade province. He sent the money back to Babylonia, and I guess that was divided, maybe, or was sent to the Reish Galusa. Line number 18, V'lo Yechad Mirashi Hashivas Mishi Ari Alov Vidova Zeh. Look at that. The Rashivas Kedmum. They didn't say words. The Resh Galusa did that, they couldn't say anything. So clearly the Resh Galusa, when you're getting the foreign powers involved, because his son wasn't properly given the right covet, I mean, please, you think that today, that's ridiculous. But the Resh Galusa was the Resh Galusa. He was like the king. And if he needed it, then that's what he did. He got the other powers involved. He got the secular powers involved, the secular kings. King of Arabia sent the message to the king of Persia. They got the money, levied a heavy tax on them, and like Tatalis, they paid, and nobody said a word. The Russian yeshivas didn't say a word. So clearly, he wielded power. He was very close to the king. That was his power, primarily. And of course, you know, he was able to get money. He was able to get money from his provinces. But how? Not stam attacks. Yeah, that also. But also by sending his dayan. So it's interesting. You always think that the Resh Galusa, the exilarch, was only in charge of the secular part, and the Rosh Yeshivas were in charge of the religious part. Not really true. Because the Resh Galusa also had his own province that he was in charge of, where he got the money, and he would send his dayan over there. And that dayan seemed to have been, yeah, he was appointed also by the Rosh Yeshivas, but he was answerable, seems to be, to the Resh Galusa. So the Resh Galusa also had his dayanim that he appointed, that he was in charge of. Yet at the same time, look what he says over here, number 19, line 19, Ukishyamus Resh Galus, when the Resh Galus died, the Resh Galusa, Kol Reshuish Lo Yinosnu L'Resh Yeshiva Sura. That who was the second in command? You have the president. The president dies. Who's in charge? The vice president. Who's the vice president? The Rosh Yeshiva of Surah. That was the number two in command. The Seifel, Rosh Golos, like the Schor Meish, Rosh Golos. Okay, fine. Now, look at number 20. The Ein L'Rosh Golos. The exilarch has no jurisdiction at all. Bin Nedovim Unedovois, Shema Hashagin Kilis Yisrael, El Yeshivas Klum. In other words, the money which was sent to the Rosh Yeshivas, to the Rosh Mesiftas, the Resh Galusa couldn't take it, had no power whatsoever. Why? Because ki eino mishagim oisom elim shelaseyim. Because the money was sent, psak geld. The money was sent to the Rosh Yeshivas, please look into the Shaila, give us an answer, and here is some money to pay for your services. And therefore, v'she'elos ein l'Rosh Galus eisik b'hem. The exilarch might have appointed his dayan to run the affairs in the province, but he clearly cannot paskin shilas coming from the whole world, and therefore that money went exclusively to the Rosh Yeshivas. Then he says, number 22, he jumps, he says, Ukumoike minik Rosh Yeshivas, kishisman echem mehem, kemen hogam lasa lakidech shosim l'resh galus. In other words, when they appoint the Rosh Yeshiva, the new Rosh Yeshiva Pumbedisa of Surah, it's the same thing that we did last week with the same ceremony in the Shabbos, in the Shul. The only difference is, Chutz Misefer Torah, Shem Ridin HaSeilov, Elu Eil Elov Kedech Kol HaAdam. In other words, by the Resh Galusa, they would bring the Sefer Torah down to him, where he would make a bracha. In other words, Fred, imagine the lane over here, and the rabbi gets Aliyah. The rabbi doesn't go off to the Bima, but they bring the Sefer Torah to the rabbi to get Aliyah over there. They only did that for the Exilach, for the Resh Galusa. Even the Rosh Yeshiva of Surah and Pumbedisa, when he got an Aliyah on his big Shabbos, when he got appointed, he had to go down to get Aliyah in the Sefer Torah. But, he says, V'chacho Yenoigim, number 24, that just like the Resh Galusa had his Dayan in their place, they appointed the Dayan in the province, number 24, Kacho Yenoigim Rosh Yeshtei Yeshivas, B'chol Mekoimois Reshu Yoseyen. The Rosh Yeshivas as well, in their provinces, remember I told you, got divided into three parts, Babel, so the Rosh Yeshivas as well, in their provinces, in other words, the Rosh Yeshivas also would be able to appoint a dayan in their provinces. And in their provinces, he would do the same thing as the dayan of the Resh Galusa. And they'd also get money. The Rosh Yeshiva would also get money through the dayan, from the butchers, from the dinei Torah, from the heads of the people. In addition, they'd also get the money on the shilas. And then he brings down, he says, Kalala Shaldova, he brings in all the various places that belong to them. Look at line 28. Kalala Shaldova, Masha Yoitze Lishu Surah, Birishuya Shaloi, what the Rosh Hashiva of Surah gets from his province, b'chol shaneh v'yir, line 28, elef betof kuf zuvim hashana, 1,500 gold coins, levad hanadorim banadoris. Besides the donations that people would send to the yeshiva, with the shayla, without the shayla, but they would send money to the yeshivas as well. So it seems to me that the Russian yeshivas, yes, maybe officially they were under the exilarch, but they were not really financially dependent on the exilarch. We don't find that the exilarch had to support the yeshivas. The yeshivas were independently financially independent. They got the money from their own areas, their provinces, where they send the day on it. They got the money from the shilas. They got the money from donations. And you know where it goes. If you're independently financially stable, then you're not that much under the jurisdiction of the exilarch. And therefore, as much as a lot is being said, the exilarch was Rosh Hashivas, I think it was more or less a division of powers, more so than the exilarch was the president, he was in charge, everybody listened to him, and Rosh Hashivas were number two and number three. I'm not convinced that's the way it was. The Rosh Hashivas themselves, they had their own autonomy to some degree. Yeah, they couldn't have an army, and they needed the exilarch for the king. And if the exilarch really wanted to, he could have probably gone to the king and said, listen, these surahs is causing me trouble, and he probably could have done that. And he did get involved at some times, and he put his foot down, and he says, no, I don't want him to be Rosh Hashiva, I want somebody else.
But we had that.
We had that. It happened a few times.
Many times.
Right? It got a few times, it happened. Only once or twice, I think, he actually got rid of somebody. Didn't happen that often. Right? You probably had a say. Yep, you all had a say. We know that Rosh Hashivas also had to appoint the exilarch to some degree. I know maybe they didn't make their decision, but I don't think necessarily the Reish Galusa, he had to approve of it, but I don't think he's the one that, depending how powerful they were. But it's not that the system was set up that the Rosh Hashivas of Surah and Pumbedisa had their own financial independence. That is very unique.
So how did they switch that?
When did it switch? Who said it switched? In Bava, this way it was.
From the time of Amoraim, we don't see this.
No. And the funny thing is...
It switched.
I don't know. The funny thing is that in Israel, right, in Eretz Israel, the Nasi and the Mesifta and the Sanhedrin was all rolled into one. It was the same person. The Nasi, Reb Yudah Nasi, was the head of the Sanhedrin. He was in charge of the Mesifta. The power was all concentrated by one. And wherever the Rosh Rebbe was, that's where the Mesifta was, that's where the Sanhedrin was, that's where the wealth was, that's where the control was. In Bavel, it was not like that. You always had three almost parallel types of systems.
So the system was set up originally by Nebuchadnezzar.
Correct.
He put the Reish Galusa
in charge.
And they just kept going. At some point or another, the yeshivas took power.
Correct. At what point did it take power? Let's analyze it. In the time of the Amoraim.
How?
Were the yeshivas in power?
No.
I mean, all we really saw is that the Amoraim, we don't find that Abaya being this wealthy person in charge of... We find that Abaya was a poor person, right?
He was poor until he got the job.
Yeah, maybe he got the job, but I'm saying he wasn't... Did he get all this money and taxes? Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that was like that.
They all became wealthy because of the position.
But in the time of the Amoraim...
But the yeshiva wasn't powerful.
And by the way, in the time of the Amoraim, I don't think they really had... They had both academies, but many times it was one was the main one and the other one was not.
So then something happened.
Something happened
during the time of
maybe in the time of the Arab conquest. Maybe it has to do with that. I don't know, but something happened that in the time of the Goyim we find that the Russia yeshivas had all this power. Sura was a power by itself. Pumbedisa was a power by itself, as was the Reish Galusa. Yes. Outwardly, the Reish Galusa was the one who was connected to the king, but the Rosh Yeshiva of Surah collected double the much funds. Maybe he needed more. He had to support all these Talmidim. That could be. But he also collected all these funds independently of the exilarch of the Reish Galusa. I don't know if we had that in the time of Amoraim. It's something I need to look into. I don't know.
I don't recall seeing it.
I don't recall seeing it, and I don't recall Chazal telling us that the Amoraim, when they were Rosh Yeshivas, that they were even made wealthy. We know by the Nasi in Israel, in Eretz Yisrael, that's where they were made wealthy.
It's
correct?
Because the power was there.
It was everything.
but it wasn't given over. It wasn't set. The system wasn't set up because most of the time the Nasi was not doing well with the government.
Yeah. Anyway.
Right. We have one time where Rabbi Yehuda Nasi or what?
So therefore, what? So therefore, he had to have his own.
He had no choice. Here, the system was set up. The Reish Galusa was the system. From the time of Nebuchadnezzar, we set it up for this way.
So you're asking how did the Rosh Hashivas get this in?
And they pulled power after the time of Amorim.
That's what I'm saying.
We have stories in the Gemara that they went to the Reish Galusa. We don't have stories that the Reish Galusa is going to them all of a sudden because the Yeshiva was such a powerhouse.
Right, right. Also, by the way, in the time of Amorim, I beg to differ with you, I don't think we find that the Amorim, Abaye Rav, right? Abaye was a independent Rosh Hashiva in Pumbedisa. He wasn't a Goyin from Pumbedisa, but he was Rosh Hashiva. He was the head of the Rosh Hashiva in Pumbedisa. He took over from Abaye, Rav Yosef, right? Rabbi Rav Yosef, Abaye Rav, they were all in Pumbedisa. We don't find, some were wealthy, I think Rabbi was wealthy, Abaye was not, I don't think was wealthy, necessarily. So, I don't think they became wealthy either. I don't think they, the Goyinim, we do find that they had all this wealth. So something must have changed. The power of the Rosh Yeshiva must have changed by the time we got to the Goyim. How it changed and why it changed, I don't know. But that's probably where the switch was made. At some point, I would think.
Clearly something happened.
How did Rabbi Gershon pick up from, because he was in Germany?
We're not holding there yet. Yeah. Fred, we got another 300 years to go for that.
So far away from that.
And then he says that you know, that sometimes if money was sent, it's interesting, on page 87, if money was sent from the outskirts, money was sent to the yeshivas, and there was no specific yeshiva sent to. It wasn't sent specifically to Surah. So whoever got the shaila, he took the money, and he divided it with yeshiva in Pumbedisa. In other words, yeshivas together, they would share the funds together. But never with the Reish Galusa. That's a separate thing. The two yeshivas would share the funds together, Surah and Pumbedisa. If there were shaylas, it was not clear where the money was going to. But if money was not shared, never between the Reish Galusa and the Rosh Yeshivas. So in a way, you know, I think that the yeshivas, you know, together for sure, they stood up, they were able to stand up against the Reish Galusa because they had their own finances. It's quite fascinating, you know, how this came about and how it worked so well. And I guess the lesson is that if you want things to work, then you have to have division of powers. Never good when it's all the powers in one hand. He had the Reish Galusa, he had his power, and believe you, he was pretty powerful, the Reish Galusa. He can go to the king and like this, he can do whatever he wants. He had all his wealth and all his power, and he had lands and all that. But the Russia yeshivas held their own, you know, as we clearly see. I thought that was quite fascinating, the setup, the way it was done in Bavel. I don't think we find this anywhere else. In Ashkenaz, we don't find this. In Germany, in Poland, in Lithuania, the Rosh Yeshivas didn't have any power to anything. They had a power over their little yeshiva, and that's it.
The government didn't give them any.
I think in the 1800s, Poland, wasn't there like these five nations that they let the Yidden govern themselves?
Correct. But was it the Rosh Yeshivas?
There was some council.
The Vada Rotzes. The Vada Rotzes, I know, but we don't find that, you know, all the Rosh Yeshivas would always go around to Adayemazeh. Go around collecting for funds because they didn't just collect taxes from the local population or from their Rishuyot. Look what they set up in Bavel. They set the whole Bavel and were dividing into three sections. One section of the jurisdiction belongs to the Reish Galusa. The other two sections belong to the Rosh Yeshivas. And not just, you know, we're just taking head taxes. No, we're not going to do that. We send a Dayan and a Bezdin and you're going to have law and order over there and Paskin Ol Yishailas. And on that, we're going to have a right to take a tax. You pay him, you pay us a little bit, and everybody is happy. Very nice system.
It seems to work.
Very good system.
The people happy paying taxes?
Yeah, because they got something in return. They didn't have to go every time they had a question, and a machlekes, and a fight, and something like that, and the butcher, we have to go to the yeshiva? No, we have our dayan over here. Fantastic. But the dayan was appointed only by the Reish Galusa, or by the Rosh Yeshivas. You couldn't just do your own thing. So maybe that was also government controlled. That you couldn't just appoint. Remember we spoke about Dayone Divova, the various Dayonim? You couldn't just appoint your own Dayan
appoint your own rav. It was always came from the top, and that must have been from the government setting like that. But the dayan, he was the one who collected the money, or his people collected the money. They would keep part for himself to run his courts, and part to send back to the Reish Galusa or to the Rosh Yeshiva. So it was a good system. It was a very good system. And everybody was happy. The Rosh Yeshiva was happy. The Reish Galusa was happy. The dayan was happy. The people were happy. It worked.
Lasted a long time.
It worked very well. Golden age for the. By the way, we find it a lot that they wielded the Rosh, the Reish Masifta, the Goyin of Surah, and the Goyin of Pumbedisa wielded a lot of power. Wielded power, not just in the halachic authority, but they were a force to be reckoned with. I don't think we necessarily find that in Ashkenaz by the Rishonim. Rashi was a force to be reckoned with. He had his yeshiva. The Ramban was a force to be reckoned with. He had a yeshiva. Right? The Beis Yosef was a force to be reckoned with. Yeah, in the learning world, they were all forced to be reckoned with. But not the Goyin, everybody knew. The Goyin from Surah, the Goyin from Bubanisa, that was a position.
There was no Reish Galusa in Ashkenaz.
I understand. But still the Rosh Yeshivas didn't have the power. And here, that we know, by the way, you growing up, you knew this, that the Goyin of Surah, the Goyin of Pumbedisa, was a powerful position. Not just in the learning world, but it was a position by itself. Correct? Now you know why. Clear. Seems to be clear.
So it didn't work the same way in Ashkenaz because it was split up too far.
Is that what it is? Or because it wasn't, meaning...